Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
The House of Mystery on KFNX Phoenix, 1100 AM Independent Talk Radio. I'm your host today, Al Warren. Joining us is kind of a household name that we all know, and she's been a prosecutor and a defense attorney, I believe, and written several books. She's got a new book out in her series called Moral Defense, which just came out in November here. Welcome to the show, Marcia Clark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's actually an honor. Thank you for being here. I have to ask, now, being in the legal world and being a prosecutor and being on a big case that everybody knows. How did you get into writing into the more fiction area of, and also from a criminal defense attorney, which is the main character in your book?
Right. That my new series is based on Samantha Brinkman, who is a criminal defense lawyer with a kind of a traumatic past and a very unusual view of the justice system. Well, I started as a defense attorney in criminal law. Those were my roots, and then I shifted over to the prosecution side, and now I'm handling criminal appeals for the indigent, court-appointed appeals. So that's where Samantha Brinkman kind of came from. I thought I had written a whole series on a prosecutor named Rachel Knight, four books in that series, and then I thought, you know, I'd like to stretch out and accommodate my roots and get into a more twisty character, because life from the defense point of view is interesting, and it gives me an opportunity to comment on our justice system and also to comment on the mentality that makes us frustrated with the way justice is sometimes administered, the way things can go wrong in a courtroom. And it's really fun to talk about that from the point of view of a character who's a rule breaker and really doesn't care what's legal.
Yeah, that's quite well, and that brings me to a point, like and as a lawyer who's worked on both sides of the criminal bench, like yourself, you're aware of the different roles. How do you describe the actual difference, like with your new character, Samantha Brinkman, in the books, as compared to being a prosecutor?
So the prosecutor's job is to make sure that a defendant is convicted, but only when the evidence proves, when there is the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to prove that he's guilty, and it's up to the prosecutor to make sure that the trial is fair. Do the best to make sure that you're doing it in a fair way, not by any underhanded means, not by hiding information or you know, twisting witness testimony or misrepresenting things to the jury. It's your job to make sure it's all done quiet, square and clean and, you know, above board. The defense attorney has no duty to do anything but represent the interests of his client. Now, of course, the defense is not supposed to, you know, play dirty tricks and lie to the jury. They're not supposed to. But there's kind of a slidey gray area there where they're simply presenting another point of view on the evidence and fairly, you know, very fairly poking holes in the prosecution's case to show the jury where there's reasonable doubt, where things were not done right, where things should have been done better, and perhaps where evidence of that's helpful to the defense was overlooked. So that's their job, is to hold the basically hold the prosecution's feet to the fire, which is a good thing. You do want those checks and balances. No side is perfect. A prosecutor, no matter how zealously careful of a defendant's rights and the rules of court can be, sometimes they miss something. You want somebody to find to catch those moments. So, but the mindset of the defense attorney is basically, I'm here to protect my client, and I don't have to worry about the people's right to a fair trial, the people of the state of California. I'm just here to take care of my client, which is, and to poke holes in the case and to show where there's reasonable doubt. So it's an entirely different mindset because the defense doesn't have to prove anything. And so I think people don't see how that side can work. Now, in my books, that side works in a very unusual way, shall I say,
yeah.
And I'm not going to give away any more than that, but I think it's kind of fun for people to see a more accurate mindset in terms of what the defense is always aiming to do.
Yeah. So I think in essence, you're saying that the defense has a lot more creative freedom with their narrative when they're talking to the jury.
Well put, yes.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Exactly. Very well put. And, okay. And so as a writer, of course, it gives you a lot more leeway to do slidey, fun things. And that'd be more fun for the reader.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Oh, yeah. No, I think they're great, great books. And I appreciate you writing them, actually. They're great. Where did you get the idea to go from this side of criminal? Like, your last series, your previous series, you were from, your main character was more, it was a prosecutor. So what made you do the switch?
Well, because I was a defense lawyer, and now I'm doing defense work again. And so I really have been on the defense side as long as I've been on the prosecution side.
Right.
And I thought, I'd like to stretch that side, you know, use my right arm instead of my left arm, or the other way around, but, yeah. You know, just kind of stretch out there. And I also wanted to write a somewhat more complex and more troubled character as the lead. I was just kind of ready to do something a little bit more twisty, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, Samantha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
when did crime start for you?
When did crime fiction or
just in your it's just your interest in your life. When did it start for you? Was it when you were young or when did you get into it?
When I was really young, maybe too young.
Well.
I mean, this has been a lifelong fascination for me. Like, you know, I mean, when I was 4 years old, I was, you know, walking through the neighborhood and looking at things, you know, spots on the sidewalk and thinking it's blood, and, you know, and it probably really wasn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was a weird kid. I was always thinking in those terms and making up crime stories and, you know, murder mysteries in my head and reading Nancy Drew and then probably books that I shouldn't be reading. As young as I was, like when I was 8, I read Compulsion, which is the story of Leopold and Loeb, very famous, what they called a thrill-killing murder of a 14-year-old boy by two very wealthy guys who, from wealthy families in Chicago suburbs, who just wanted to create the perfect crime. And, you know, at 8 years old, there's not a lot that I understood about that story. But I later reread it because it's been reissued. Compulsion has been reissued, and it's fantastic. It's a fantastically written book.
Yeah.
So anyway, my interest in this is deep and long.
Yeah. So it's something you've always been part of. I have to say, so if you had to describe Samantha Brinkman, your character, how would you describe her?
Okay, so Samantha Brinkman is definitely a survivor. She was raised by a mother who did not want her, who found out that she was pregnant too late to do anything about it, and she would have. Her mother, a beautiful woman from very poor means, wanted nothing more than a very rich boyfriend or husband. And when she found out that the man who got her pregnant was not rich, back when she was in college, she left him immediately. And so Samantha was raised by a narcissistic mother who dragged her from one boyfriend to the next in search of the ultimate sugar daddy, and ultimately found that sugar daddy in a truly horrible person who almost destroyed Sam. And then luckily, only because Sam really threatened her mother, threatened to call the police, her mother finally left him, and she eventually landed a nice man who happened to be a billionaire. Actually, the accident for her mother, Celeste, was that he happened to be a nice guy because she was marrying his money. He saw that Sam was going rapidly down a very fast spiral with drugs and all the rest of it, as abused children will, and helped her out of it, and she decided to become a lawyer and in her own way deliver justice. So she identifies with the underdog, but she also very much recognizes that there are some who really deserve what they get and then some. And so she finds a way to make justice prevail in her own way.
Yeah, I'd say that. are there people in your life that you've drawn to create this character?
Almost certainly. You know, I didn't used to think so. I used to think, oh, they're all fictional. I make it all up. But you know, with a little hindsight and time that has passed since I started writing fiction, I realized they all come in one way or another. Of course, I change them. I pull them out, I twist them up a little bit, but everything that I'm writing about is in some way something I'm drawing on from my own experiences as a person, as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney. I'm drawing on all of that. So there's a lot of real life experience in these books, more than I ever realized, and I'm sorry to say it because I wish I could claim to be that inventive, but, you know.
well, you're it sounds like you're taking the character and you're sort of putting them in different situations, though.
So
that's
great. And
there's
a lot of wish fulfillment, too, you know.
Yeah. So do you miss being a prosecutor?
No. You know, there was a time when I first left the office. It was very weird after 14 years of being a prosecutor. I thought I was going to do it for the rest of my life, and I planned to. That was the whole idea. And so it took a few years for me to adjust to the idea that probably it's time to find a new life. But especially now that I'm able to write crime fiction and also practice law in a way that, you know, lets me juggle both, and now I'm also co-writing a pilot for NBC based on Samantha Brinkman for a one-hour drama. It kind of feels like I've segued into another part of my life, and I'm enjoying it.
Oh, that's great. No, that sounds interesting. How do you feel about the justice system, being involved in it so long and now even writing about it? Do you feel like it's in the right direction? Do you feel like it's a good system?
You know, I guess like any of us, I feel like it has its strengths and its weaknesses, you know? My feelings about it are so ambivalent. You know, I just don't know the better one. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I think I think in general, we try to do the right thing. In general, we try to protect the rights of both victims and defendants. In specific, not so much. There are times, obviously, when the wrong thing happens, when innocent people get convicted who shouldn't be, and we've seen the stories about that. Certainly, we've seen the stories of guilty people who don't get convicted. So, we don't know what I could be talking about here.
No.
But, you know, these things happen in a system that is run by humans. You know, we're flawed and we make mistakes, and so it's bound to happen that mistakes will be made. So, you know, I do have my feelings about it, and I do think that there probably are ways to improve it, but I haven't seen a system that works better.
Yeah. How do you feel about the televising of cases?
Again, this is a mixed bag for me. I initially felt that I never wanted cameras in the courtroom because it has an obvious skewing impact on how cases are tried. Lawyers pander to the camera and get to make nonsense motions or just really sensationalist, engage in sensationalist rhetoric that is had no place in a courtroom. Judges can pander to the limelight as well, as we saw. And in general, and witnesses come forward who maybe have nothing to say but want the limelight. Other witnesses stay away because they don't want the limelight. So there's what to worry about in terms of having cameras in the courtroom. On the other hand, I think it's really important that the public know what's going on, and I think that can have a normalizing or a balancing effect, because juries can go nuts. You know, it can happen. Juries don't necessarily do the right thing. And I'm really not just talking about Simpson. I'm talking about in general. Weird things can happen in a courtroom, especially when a judge doesn't control the proceedings the way he should. So it's important that the public know about this, that they see. So I guess what I would do if I were king, what I would probably do is kick the cameras out of the courtroom when the jury isn't there. If the jury can't see it, then neither should the public see it. Unless they want to come and sit in the courtroom, and they're welcome to do that. I don't think there's as much a problem with print reporters reporting everything as there is with the camera, which reaches millions and millions, whereas people are less inclined to just read about it. And I think print reporters can be more accurate in terms of putting things into context. Now, not necessarily, as we know. You know, print reporters can screw it up, too, mm-hmm. and go for sensationalist headlines and really skew the facts to a point that they're unrecognizable. But in general, there's less danger with a print reporter sitting in the courtroom than there is with a camera. So what you want, ideally, is to have proceedings recorded in a manner that informs the public but does not taint the jury.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's tough. I just know from a personal experience of just even being on radio that when you first start doing things that are public, and you start to get feedback and listen to it, you change the way you act. And so I would just think it would be incredible. Yeah. I couldn't imagine people filming me and then people talking about, you know, what I'm wearing or my hair or my... I would just... it would freak me out. I would actually change my behavior. You know, I'd come to work with a hat on.
Now, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, well, there you go. You know?
That would have been my answer. Right there. A hat would change so much.
Yeah, baseball cap.
So, you really do have to, you have to really make a conscious effort to disregard all of that and resist the temptation to bend with public opinion when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're trying a case to a jury. You're not trying a case to the guy across the street or the girl sitting in the park. You know, you have to appeal to the jury you have. You know, somebody on the outside could say, I want you to be more fiery here, or I want you to be stronger there, or whatever. No, but I have to appeal to this jury, not you, to them. And the way they perceive what's going on in court is all that matters to me. And just kind of narrow focus in that way. So, sometimes it's appropriate to bang the podium and scream and yell, and other times that's going to turn your jury off so much they'll never listen to another word you say. So you have to be in touch with who your jury is and resist the temptation to pander to, you know, people on the outside who are not the ones that matter.
Yeah. Well, it's just, in Arizona we had the Jody Arias, and that was a pretty big case and televised. And you look at the Kirk Nurmi and the defense, and I chatted with him and had interviews with him, and he was threatened his life, and the things that he had to go through because it was so televised, so public. I just sort of think that how... I don't know that I could do my job properly.
Yeah, it's scary, and I think that's so wildly inappropriate. The defense attorneys have a job to do. It's an important job. We need them. We need that balance. You don't just want prosecutors up there with no answer to them, and there's no question that would be lead to terrible abuses.
Yeah.
Not because necessarily, 99.9% of the prosecutors are going to do their best to be fair and impartial, but they can miss stuff. Like I said before, you need somebody sitting on the other side from the outside, poking holes in the things they don't see. And if you don't have that person, you really don't have a system of justice. You have, it's way out of whack. So it's unfair and a terrible thing. I hate to hear that when defense attorneys are threatened that way. I understand you don't like what they're doing. You maybe have an opinion about how they're doing it. That's cool. Everybody's entitled to one. At least one. We all have them. But to get, that kind of stuff, the threats, that's just not okay.
Yeah. I that's what I thought. I thought that what a terrible stress to be put under.
Mm-hmm.
And, and with all the drama with, like, Making a Murderer and all those with Steve Avery, there seems to be a real negative about prosecutors in that sense. And do you think that's realistic? I mean, because when you see that show, people tend to get the idea that prosecutors will do what they have to get conviction. They're not really concerned about if he did it or not.
Right. That's so not been my experience at all. I can only speak from my experience and prosecutors I knew. Nobody was out to get them no matter what, we'll give them a fair trial and then we'll hang them, you know?
Yeah.
It's not the mentality I ever saw. Does that mean it doesn't exist? Of course not. There are thousands and thousands of prosecutors in this country, and there's bound to be a few bad apples, because that's the way it is in every profession. There's always a few. But making of a murder, that prosecutor did not come across that well. And the kind of ghoulish news conferences he was giving in the very beginning before he even picked a jury, it's one thing to say, these are the charges, we have the evidence, and that sort of thing. But the gruesome detail, graphic detail, and in large part, I think we find, in some respects anyway, not necessarily accurate detail, he's already spinning the jury, and that's not appropriate. That kind of thing where you're really vilifying the defendant with yet unproven things, evidence, is never okay to do. And I think that kind of, in hindsight, of course, I think not at the time, made us all kind of recoil and say, that's just too far, he shouldn't be doing that. But I don't think people, I hope not anyway, I hope people don't think that that's emblematic of most prosecutors. And in some respects, those documentaries can be such a good thing, because, again, they show people what's going on and what happened. But they can be a bad thing, too, if they're edited in a way that makes them inaccurate. That if they're leaving out important incriminating evidence, then you don't get an accurate picture of what the case was all about and what they had against the defendants. So, you know, I'm just hoping that these documentarians have some scruples about what they're doing so that people are not misled.
Yeah. Now both main characters in all of your books, both Rachel Knight and now Samantha Brinkman, strong females. Do you think it's, how do I say, how is it being in the legal system as a female? Is it equal? Is it, what's your opinion on that?
Mm-hmm. So it depends on what court you're in. You know, it really does. The judge is the director of the show, so to speak. You know, on a film set, the director yells cut, that's the judge. And if the judge is sexist, if the judge views the female lawyer in the courtroom on either side as a second-class citizen, you're going to feel it. You're going to feel it every day. You're going to feel it in the rulings, you're going to feel it in the way he behaves towards you, the way he talks to you in front of the jury. So in some courts, that happens. It happened, of course, in Simpson, all over the place. I've never seen such condescending, demeaning behavior towards me from a judge in my entire career as a defense attorney or as a prosecutor. And that tells you something, because the other judges, even judges who had been around at a time when there were no women in the courtroom, were much more fair, much less condescending and demeaning than Judge Ito was. So it depends on the courtroom. Every trial then becomes an experiment of one for us.
Yeah, it's got to be. It's a whole new challenge every time you walk into a new courtroom and a new setting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, you never know.
You never know, yeah. Oh, who are your biggest influences?
In life?
Yeah,
that's a big question.
well, I mean, as specifically, yeah. Oh my God, no. As in, like, who is there? Writers or filmmakers or just people that have had a large influence in your life that maybe influence your writing itself.
The influence on my writing, in particular, it's hard. There's so many and for so many different reasons. So, okay, I'm going to tell you, and then I know that we're going to hang up, and I'm going to say, and I forgot to say this and that. I'm going to blow it. And so, knowing that I'm about to blow it, here's my answer. certainly James Ellroy, certainly Jim Thompson, certainly Raymond Chandler. I think Nancy Drew, that's an early one. Patricia Highsmith, she wrote the Mr. Ripley series, amazing writer. Yeah, I mean, really, a lot of noir. A lot of noir influenced me, as well as lighter fare, too. And I'm trying to think now. Anita Shreve was an influence. I loved her stuff. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, no, I know, no, I throw that out there. It's tough, you know. And
I know it's not. Now I'm reading. Oh God, there's more. I don't
know. No, it's not that. Just NPR background, so I'm very I'm dry. So the Simpson case was, of course, huge. Are there other cases that really influenced you that you had to watch that were, you know, or follow that was riveting, like, you know, Charles Manson or anything that sort of, you know, you were really intent on seeing how it was done?
Charles Manson, that's a great example.
Yeah.
I forgot about that. I was pretty young when that was happening. But yeah, I remember being fascinated by why, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think that to me, in that case, that's one of those cases that the why of it is so mystifying. How could you, why would you target this young woman? I mean, you know, senseless doesn't begin to describe it. And then that your followers, who are, you know, young women in part, that they could be drawn into something like this, this horrific thing, that just, it completely befuddled me. I just was mystified by it. I remember being, and I had to read Helter Skelter to get a grip on it, and still felt like it was inexplicable and horrifying. The kind of an example of a Jonestown mentality that, you know, people can be, you get the right person at the right time, and you can convince them of almost anything, and that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think kind of one of the cornerstones of the Manson case. What else? There was, I remember also, not long after that, being fascinated by Patricia Hearst.
Oh,
along
yeah.
the same lines.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, kind of interesting, again, the why of it, you know?
Yeah, and that's crazy. You know, I just did an interview with Bradley Schreiber. He's got evidence now that Patty Hearst was visiting the leader of the PLO in jail a year before the kidnapping.
Ooh, interesting.
Isn't that it, like the whole question of was she hypnotized, you know, or Stockholm Syndrome, and then you come
right.
to and you know, the whole scenario, and now to come back and go, well, she knew him before.
That is.
What is, you know, what does that mean? Like, doesn't that throw the whole right? thing? I find that really interesting.
It does?
You know?
Oh, that definitely makes a difference. I have to tell you, at the time of that trial, I was not yet practicing law, but it was shortly there, not too long thereafter, that I joined, I became a lawyer and was working at a defense law firm, criminal defense. And it was largely the view of the criminal defense community that Effie Bailey screwed that case up, that it was an eminently defensible case, that she should have gotten maybe not necessarily acquitted, but lesser charges, and that he blew it.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was so much evidence of, at the time, of Stockholm Syndrome, of her being pressured and threatened, and, you know, all of the things that happen to someone who is kept prisoner for a period of time. So, but at that time, no one knew
right.
that she had already been in contact with one of them.
Yeah, and that's just crazy.
Are you saying that she was actually visiting somebody from the NSLA?
Yeah, she was going in and visiting. He was in jail for some petty crimes. And
mm-hmm.
she was. They have her signed in, going and visiting her, and this is a year before any of that happened. But you know, at the time, they didn't know this, and I guess they didn't.
Wow.
They
yeah,
didn't,
no.
You know, I know it's crazy. And yeah. Talk about Manson, a really good series. Have you seen that Aquarius yet?
No.
Oh, watch it.
It was up on Is it good?
Oh, it's incredible. They do it so well. They cover Manson from a personality of, you know, you get to see his relationship mm-hmm. with his mother. You get mm-hmm. to see what was going on. And you start to see him and what he was doing and how he maneuvered people, how he could mm-hmm. manipulate someone that seemed intelligent into following him and getting them wow. involved. I think they did it really well. I was pretty thrilled.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, but that sort of history fascinates me. One other question here. So what does Marcia Clark do when she's not writing and she's not in court?
Well, we don't have to go to court very much on appeal. It's all in writing.
Yeah.
And really all I'm doing is writing right now. But I don't have time. Because I'm writing the third book in the Samantha series.
Yeah.
I'm working on the NBC pilot. And I'm also still handling a caseload. So what free time?
Yeah. there you have it.
Sleeping.
sleeping. I know. It can never get enough, eh? I don't know.
Right.
Man, so much going on. Well, it's certainly a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure talking to you as well.
It's wonderful. And again, our guest has been Marcia Clark, the one and only. And her new book, Moral Defense. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.